Mahabharata, Chapter 4. Duryodhan begins his evil schemes. The Pandavas began to enjoy life in Hastinapur. They sported with the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra, who became known as the Kauravas. Pandu's sons excel the Kauravas in all areas, in strength, knowledge, and prowess with weaponry. Bhima was especially powerful, and he took delight in defeating the Kauravas in sport. They could not equal him in anything. The exuberant Bhima possessed the indefatigable power of his divine father. At wrestling and fighting, he was unapproachable and could easily hold off the attacks of any number of Kauravas. Out of a boyish sense of fun, he would often play practical jokes on them, laughing when they became angered and tried futilely to get back at him. Duryodhan, in particular, found Bhima's antics and power intolerable. As the eldest son of the blind king, Duryodhan had enjoyed the most prestige in the Kuru house. The Kuru elders had carefully raised him and trained him in the kingly arts, thinking of him as the potential future world emperor. Mindful of the omen seen at his birth, the elders were especially careful to teach him moral codes. The prince was both powerful and capable in all areas of weaponry and politics, and was accustomed to being the center of attention in the royal palace since his birth. When the Pandavas arrived, however, all that changed. Pandu's sons were gentle, modest, and devoted to their elders. They soon became dear to Bhishma, Vidura, and the other senior Kurus. Their behavior was a welcome change from that of Duryodhan and his brothers, who tended to be self-centered and proud, and often quite arrogant. Duryodhan quickly became envious of his 5 cousins. His envy grew like an oil-fed fire when he saw Bhima's pranks. After another day of humiliation at Bhima's hands, Duryodhan felt he could take no more. He spoke with Dushasan, the next eldest of the 100 Kauravas. "Dear brother, this Bhima is a constant thorn in our sides. He challenges all 100 of us at once and throws us about like pieces of straw. We cannot better him at anything. Why, even at eating he humbles us by consuming as much as 20 of us put together. Something has to be done to check his pride." Duryodhan's eyes narrowed as he spoke. His intentions were vicious. The prince was inclined to wicked acts, and he had been spurred on by his uncle Shakuni, who had taken up residence in Hastinapur. The Gandhara prince had been offended by Bhishma's decision to give his sister to the blind Dhritarashtra rather than to Pandu, and now he wanted revenge. He involved himself in court intrigues in order to find a way to avenge himself against Bhishma. Hurting the Pandavas, who were obviously dear to Bhishma, was one good way. And of course, he would be simultaneously advancing the cause of his sister's sons. Duryodhan was a willing accomplice. The boy saw his scheming uncle as a mentor. When Duryodhan had come to him complaining about Bhima, it did not take much to convince him to do something terrible to the Pandava boy. Duryodhan revealed his heinous plan to Dushasan. "Tomorrow I shall feed Bhima an enormous poisoned feast. When he falls unconscious after eating, I shall bind his limbs and toss him into the Ganges. With Bhima gone, the other brothers are helpless. We can easily deal with them. Thus my claim to the throne will be unchallenged." Dushasan smiled in agreement. He too found Bhima's behavior intolerable, and, like Duryodhan, had also found his own status in the Kuru house diminish since the Pandavas' arrival. He put his arm around his brother, and the two of them made their way back to the palace, laughing together as they walked the forest path. The next morning, Duryodhan suggested that all the princes go to the river for some water sports. Soon they mounted their shining chariots, which resembled cities, and had great wheels which rumbled like thunderclouds as they headed out, sending up clouds of dust. Upon arriving on the river bank, the mighty youths dismounted from their cars, laughing and joking, and entered the large pleasure house Dhritarashtra had built for them. The elegant palace was built of white marble, and it stood 7 stories high. Many-colored pennants flew from tall golden flagstaffs on the roof. There were dozens of rooms offering every kind of luxury. Each room was tastefully decorated with tapestries, fine paintings, and ivory and coral furnishings, studded with gems and covered with golden cushions. Royal musicians and dancers stood by, ready to entertain the princes, and 100 of the king's select force of bodyguards stood ready to protect them. Once inside, Duryodhan invited everyone to enjoy the great feast he had arranged for them. He led them through the mansion and out into the central gardens. The boys looked with pleasure upon the large ponds filled with red and blue lotuses and surrounded by soft, grassy banks. Crystal waterfalls made tinkling sounds that blended with the singing of brightly colored exotic birds. The heady scent of numerous blossoms filled the air. Fine cushions had been arranged in lines on the grass, and many servants stood by, waiting to serve the feast. Duryodhan chose the seat next to Bhima. He then ordered the servants to bring the food. The dishes were exquisite. Duryodhan had personally mixed the poison with the food that he brought to him. He then offered the plate to Bhima, feigning love, and feeding him with his own hand. The guileless Bhima suspected nothing, and he cheerfully consumed his normal amount. Duryodhan rejoiced within as Bhima hungrily swallowed the poisoned cakes, pies, creams, drinks, and other preparations. When the feast was over, Duryodhan suggested they all go down to the river for sport. The boys raced to the river in great joy. They wrestled and rolled around on the ground, tossing each other into the clear blue water of the river. As usual, Bhima was the most energetic. The poison did not appear to have affected him. The prince, who stood head and shoulders above his peers, was a peerless wrestler. Anyone who approached him quickly found themselves sailing through the air and landing in the water. Bhima would then dive in and create huge waves by thrashing his arms. The other princes were then dunked under the waters by the playful Bhima. Late in the afternoon, the boys began to tire. They came out of the water and dressed themselves in white robes, adorned with gold ornaments. Then they wearily made their way back to the mansion to spend the night. Bhima had consumed enough poison to kill 100 men, but it was not until evening that the wind god's son began to feel its effects. As night fell, he felt so drowsy that he decided to lay down by the river and rest. Gradually, he lapsed into a deep sleep. When the other princes had gone back to the mansion, Duryodhan saw his opportunity. Along with Dushasan, he bound Bhima's arms and legs with strong cords. Looking furtively around, the brothers quickly rolled the unconscious prince into the river. Bhima sank to the bottom of the river and was carried by underwater currents. The celestial abode of the divine serpent beings, the Nagas, could be reached through the Ganges, and Bhima was swept along a mystical path right into their midst. At once, the snakes began to bite the human that had so suddenly arrived among them. Their virulent poison proved to be the antidote to the plant poison Duryodhan had administered. Bhima slowly came back to his senses as the effect of the poison wore off. He woke to find himself on a strange river bank, surrounded by large serpents bearing their fangs. Bhima burst the cords binding his limbs. He picked up the snakes and dashed them to the ground. He pressed some into the earth with his feet and hurled others to a distance. Seeing him render dozens of snakes unconscious, the others fled away in terror. The Nagas went quickly to their king, Vasuki. With fearful voices they said, "O king, a human fell among us, bound with cords. Perhaps he had been poisoned, for he was unconscious. When we bit him, he regained his senses and overpowered us. You should go to him at once." Vasuki assumed a human form, rose from his bejeweled throne, and walked gracefully out of his palace. Arka, a Naga chief, went with him. Arka had long ago lived upon the earth in human society. He was Kunti's great-grandfather, and he immediately recognized Bhima as his great-grandson. Smiling, he introduced himself and embraced the prince. Seeing this, Vasuki was pleased and said to Arka, "What service can we render this boy? Let us give him an abundance of gems and gold." Arka looked at the powerful Bhima and replied, "I think this prince would be best served by us if we let him partake of our rasa." Vasuki agreed. Bringing Bhima back to his palace, he arranged for pots of the ambrosial rasa to be brought for him. This drink was distilled from celestial herbs, and by drinking even one pot, a man would become permanently endowed with the vigor and strength of 1,000 elephants. The Nagas placed a number of pots in front of Bhima and invited him to drink. Bhima sat facing the east, as he always did before eating or drinking, and offered prayers to the Lord. He then lifted one of the large pots of rasa and quaffed it down in one gulp. The Nagas watched in amazement as Bhima drank 8 pots of the divine elixir, each in a single draught. Even the most powerful among them would not have been capable of such a feat. After Bhima had satisfied himself with the rasa, he again felt drowsy. Vasuki offered him a celestial bed, and the prince lay down. He remained in a deep sleep for 8 days as his body assimilated the rasa. On the 9th day he awoke, feeling strong beyond measure. The Nagas told him that the rasa had given him the strength of 10,000 elephants. He would now be invincible in battle. Vasuki told Bhima to bathe in the nearby sacred waters of the Mandakini, then dress himself in the robes the Naga king had brought for him. He should then quickly return to his home, as his relatives were in much anxiety about him. After he had bathed and eaten the celestial foods the Nagas provided, Bhima, dressed in white silks and gold ornaments, was led to the river. They entered with Bhima, and within moments they brought him out of the water, near the place that he had been pushed in. Filled with wonder, Bhima ran back to Hastinapur. In the city, Kunti saw her sons arrive without Bhima. The other princes were surprised that he was not already there. They had assumed he must have gone ahead without them. Duryodhan and Dushasan feigned concern, but secretly they rejoiced, thinking Bhima to be dead. The virtuous-minded Yudhisthira believed that the others were as honest as he was. Suspecting nothing, he told his mother, "We searched for Bhima in the gardens and mansion for a long time. We went into the woods and called out for him. Finally, we concluded that he must have already left." Yudhisthira became fearful. Perhaps Bhima had been killed. Kunti shared his fears, and she asked him again to go to the mansion with his brothers and search for the missing Bhima. When her sons left, she summoned Vidura and said, "O wise one, I am afraid for Bhima's safety. He did not return with the others. I often see an evil look in Duryodhan's eye. I know he is filled with malice toward Bhima. Perhaps he has killed him." Kunti hoped Vidura would give her solace. His words were always deeply considered and comforting. Vidura did not disappoint her. He replied, "Do not think in this way, O gentle lady. The great Rishi Vyasadeva has said that your sons will be long-lived. His words can never be false. Nor indeed can those of the gods who have predicted a great future for your sons." Still, Vidura remembered the omens surrounding Duryodhan's birth. He warned Kunti to be on her guard. The evil prince might try anything. For 8 days, Kunti and her sons waited anxiously for any news of Bhima. Then, early on the ninth day, they saw him running towards them, his white silks flowing in the wind. He came straight to Kunti and bowed at her feet. As he rose, each of his brothers embraced him warmly. With tears of joy, they eagerly asked where he had been. Bhima knew everything about the circumstances by which he had come to be in the river. When he had found himself bound with cords, he had suspected the envious Duryodhan. Vasuki had confirmed his suspicions. The Naga king could see everything by virtue of his divine sight. Bhima related the whole story to his brothers, how he had gone to the Naga kingdom and been given the rasa. The brothers could understand that even though the Kauravas had plotted Bhima's death, somehow, by the arrangement of providence, he had become most fortunate. Yudhisthira was shocked to learn of his cousin's antagonism. He considered the situation carefully. If their elders were informed of what had occurred, then there would be open enmity between the princes. Duryodhan would certainly try to dispose of them as quickly as possible, and the Pandavas' position was not strong. Their father was dead, and Dhritarashtra was the king. He doted on Duryodhan and his other sons, and it was unlikely he would side against his own sons to protect his nephews. Yudhisthira ordered his brothers to remain silent. They should tell no one about what had occurred. Kunti, however, confided in Vidura. He advised her to follow Yudhisthira's suggestion. Thus the Pandavas said nothing, but from that day forward they became vigilant, always watching the Kauravas, especially Duryodhan and Dushasan. Besides Gandhari's 100 sons, Dhritarashtra had conceived another son by a servant maid who had waited upon him during his wife's lengthy pregnancy. Unlike his half-brothers, this boy, Yuyutsu, felt no envy or antagonism toward the Pandavas. One day he secretly informed Yudhisthira that Duryodhan, who had been deeply disappointed to see that his plan to kill Bhima had failed, had again cooked a large quantity of the deadly Datura poison into Bhima's enormous meal. Bhima laughed when he heard the news. Having drunk the Naga's celestial elixir, he had no fear of Duryodhan. He sat down before him and cheerfully consumed the entire quantity of poisoned food. Duryodhan was amazed to see that Bhima was not in the least affected. He gazed at the Pandava with open hatred. Although the Kaurava princes detested the Pandavas, Bhishma and Vidura loved them and would spend much time with the five virtuous and gentle princes. Bhishma had been especially fatherly toward them since the time they had arrived from the forest. He had been fond of Pandu, and now he felt the same fondness for Pandu's sons. The boys reciprocated his love and served him in various ways. The Pandavas were also favored by their military teacher, Kripa. Kripa was the noble-minded son of a Brahmin who had adopted the warrior's profession. He told the princes his history. His father, a rishi named Gotama, had been engaged in fierce austerities and weaponry practice, for which he had an affinity. Gotama's asceticism and martial skills were so great that even Indra feared that the rishi might exceed him in power and usurp his position in heaven. That anxious god therefore sent a beautiful apsara, a heavenly nymph, to divert Gotama from his asceticism. When the rishi saw the semi-clad apsara before him, he lost control of his mind, and semen fell from his body. It landed in a clump of heath, and from it two children were born. Gotama fled after seeing the apsara, not realizing that he had miraculously sired the children. Soon after he left, some of the king's soldiers found the two babies and brought them into Hastinapur. Some time later, Gotama, understanding everything by his mystic power, came to the city and explained to the king what had happened. The rishi taught his son all his military skills, and in time Kripa became the teacher of the princes. Bhishma was pleased with Kripa's teachings. The boys were becoming highly adept at weaponry, but he wanted them to learn the secrets of the celestial weapons as well, so that they would be unmatched in warfare. Kripa did not have this knowledge. Bhishma had therefore begun searching for a suitable teacher to take the princes further in their military science. None he had seen had impressed him as qualified to train the princes. Then one day the boys ran into Bhishma with a strange tale to tell. They had been out playing ball in the woods. The ball fell into a deep, dry well, and the princes could not recover it. As they stood by the well, looking at one another in embarrassment, a dark man approached them. He was a Brahmin, appearing emaciated and poor, but with a bright effulgence and glowing eyes. The princes surrounded the Brahmin and asked if he could help them. Smiling a little, the Brahmin said, "Shame upon your prowess as warriors. What is the use of your skill in arms if you cannot even retrieve a lost ball? If you give me a meal, I'll recover the ball, as well as this ring of mine." And he took off his ring and threw it into the well. Yudhisthir said to him, "O Brahmin, if you can recover the ball and the ring, then with Kripa's permission we shall ensure that you are maintained for your whole life." The Brahmin took a handful of long grasses and said, "Watch as I invest these grasses with the power of weapons. With these I shall pierce the ball and bring it to the surface." He chanted mantras and threw the grasses one by one into the well. The first one pierced the ball, and each subsequent blade he threw stuck into the last one to form a long chain. The Brahmin then pulled the ball out of the well. The princes were astonished. "This is truly wonderful, but let us now see you raise the ring." The Brahmin borrowed one of the prince's bows and shot a single sharp-pointed arrow into the well. With it he brought up the ring, caught on the arrow's head. The princes crowded around him and asked him to reveal his identity. They had never seen such skill. The Brahmin told them to go to Bhishma and describe what they had seen. He would know his identity. The Brahmin said he would wait there until they returned. The boys ran back to the city and told Bhishma everything. When he heard the tale, his eyes shone with joy. Surely this could only be Drona, the disciple of his own martial teacher, Parasuram. Bhishma had heard much about Drona from the rishis. This was certainly providential. The princes could have no better teacher. Bhishma went in person with the boys to see the Brahmin. Finding, as he had suspected, that it was Drona, Bhishma immediately offered him the position of a royal teacher. Drona accepted and went to Hastinapur with Bhishma. When they were back in the city, Bhishma had Drona tell everyone of his history. Drona looked around at the eager-faced princes. They wanted to know everything about this unusual Brahmin. He was the son of Bharadvaj, the all-powerful rishi who had dwelt for thousands of years in the deep forest, and who, not long ago, had finally ascended to heaven. Although he too was a Brahmin, Drona was inclined toward martial arts. While living in his father's hermitage, he had learned the science of arms from Agnivesha, another powerful rishi. He had also received knowledge of the celestial weapons from the great Parasuram. Despite having such great learning, however, Drona remained a poverty-stricken Brahmin. He could hardly maintain his family. Thus he had been on his way to Hastinapur, hoping to be engaged as the prince's teacher. Bhishma said, "Make your residence here in the city. You shall enjoy every luxury along with the Kurus. Indeed, the Kurus are at your command. Whatever wealth, kingdoms, and followers that belong to our house are also yours. O best of the Brahmins, it is our good fortune that you have arrived here." Drona was given a large, well-furnished house, stocked with everything enjoyable, and attended by many servants. He then brought his wife and son to Hastinapur to live among the Kurus with him, and he accepted both the Pandavas and Kauravas as his disciples. Drona taught the princes everything he knew about weaponry. The boys practiced every day from dawn till dusk. As the news of his martial school spread, princes from other kingdoms also came to learn from the famous Drona. The Vrishnis, the Andakas, and other famous and powerful dynasties sent their princes to Drona, and he accepted them all as his pupils. Soon Drona had thousands of students. Among all the boys, Arjuna excelled at his lessons. He remained always at Drona's side, eager to learn any little skill or extra tips. His ability, speed, perseverance, and determination were unequaled by the other princes. Arjuna became foremost. Drona felt none could match his skills. Out of his natural fatherly affection, Drona also wished to impart extra lessons to his own son, Ashvatthama. He gave all the princes narrow-mouthed water pots and asked them to fill them at the river, but to his own son he gave a wide-mouthed pot so he could return first and receive extra teaching. Arjuna realized Drona's intentions, and he filled his own pot with a celestial water weapon and thus returned before Ashvatthama. Drona smiled when he saw Arjuna's determination. His desire to learn from his preceptor was beyond compare. Arjuna always carefully worshipped Drona and was very attentive to his every command. Because of his devotion to studies and his guru, he became Drona's favorite student. Once, Arjuna was eating his meal at night. Suddenly, the lamp blew out. It was pitch black. Arjuna continued to eat as if nothing had happened. As he did so, he realized that simply by habit, he was able to place the food in his mouth, although he could see nothing in the darkness. He then began to practice with his bow and arrows in the night, aiming at invisible targets. When Drona saw this dedication, he was overjoyed. He told Arjuna, "I shall make you unmatched upon the earth. No warrior shall be your equal." Drona then taught Arjuna how to fight on horseback, on an elephant, from chariots, and on the ground. He showed him all the skills of fighting with clubs, swords, lances, spears, and darts, as well as many other types of weapons. Drona also taught him how to contend with any number of warriors fighting at once. As Drona promised, his skill soon became without compare on earth. One day, a prince of the Nishada tribe of forest dwellers asked Drona to teach him. His name was Ekalavya. Drona replied that his school was only for kings and princes. Ekalavya went away dismayed. Strongly desiring greatness in martial sciences, he practiced alone in the woods. He built an effigy of Drona and worshipped him daily, praying to him for skills at weaponry. Gradually, he became an expert archer. Once, as he was practicing, a dog began to bark loudly and disturb him. Immediately, he released 7 arrows, even without seeing the dog, and sealed the animal's mouth. It so happened that Arjuna and his brothers were in the woods at the time, and they saw the dog, its mouth closed with arrows. They marveled at this and wondered who was responsible for such a feat. Soon they came upon Ekalavya, and seeing the dark-skinned Nishada, smeared with filth, his hair matted, they asked him who he was. He replied, "I am Ekalavya of the Nishadas, a disciple of Drona. I practice alone in these woods, with a desire to become the best of archers." Arjuna was seized with anxiety. This boy posed himself as a disciple of Drona, even though he had been rejected by him. It was completely against all religious principles. No one could claim to be a disciple of a guru unless he was accepted as such by that teacher. And Ekalavya had even flouted his so-called guru's order. Drona had told Ekalavya that he could not be his student. The Nishada clearly had no devotion to Drona, despite his outward show of dedication, as he did not accept Jonah's order. How then could he be allowed to present himself as Jonah's disciple, and practically his best one at that? His skills were astonishing, but they had been gained by disobedience. Arjuna went at once to his guru to inform him. After bowing at Jonah's feet, Arjuna said, O Master, embracing me to your bosom, you told me that I shall be the best of all your students. By your grace, this has become true. But I see you have another disciple, the mighty Nishada prince, Ekalavya, whose skills approach mine. The warrior practices alone in the forest, worshipping your holy feet. Has he become my equal? Jonah was immediately perturbed. He remembered dismissing Ekalavya, and he could understand Arjuna's intimations and anxiety. After thinking for some moments, he replied, Come with me, Arjuna. We shall see today what caliber of disciple is this prince. Jonah went at once with Arjuna into the woods. When Ekalavya saw them approach, he fell to the ground and touched Jonah's feet. Then he stood before Jonah with folded palms, saying, My lord, I am your disciple. Please order me as you will. Jonah looked with surprise at Ekalavya and at his own effigy nearby. He recalled the day the forest prince had come to him and been turned away. Jonah was angered that he was now claiming to be his student. The Kuru preceptor had not desired to impart any martial skills to Ekalavya. Generally, the lower-class tribespeople lacked the virtuous qualities of royalty. They did not follow the Vedic religion. To give a low-class man great martial power could be dangerous. Jonah had been especially concerned about Ekalavya, as the Nishada tribe did not cooperate with the Kuru's virtuous rule. Jonah would not accept any princes into his school if they belonged to races antagonistic to the Kurus. Jonah stood thinking for some time. His first assessment of Ekalavya had obviously been correct. The Nishada had shown himself to be lacking in virtue by falsely posing as his disciple. Clearly, he desired only to be great, known as a student of the famous teacher, but not to actually obey him. Smiling a little, Jonah said to the Nishada, O hero, if you really wish to be my disciple, then you must give me some dakshin. The disciple should be prepared to give anything to his guru. Therefore, I ask you to give me your right thumb. Jonah knew that this was asking a lot from Ekalavya. The loss of his thumb would impair his skill at bowmanship. But if he wanted to be known as Jonah's disciple, he could not refuse. Jonah also wanted to show that one cannot please his teacher and achieve perfection by dishonest means. By taking Ekalavya's thumb, he was also removing any threat he or his race might pose to the Kurus. Jonah looked expectantly at the Nishada prince. Ekalavya immediately took out his hunting knife. Although he had been unable to accept Jonah's first order, the prince did not want to be considered at fault for failing to give dakshin to his guru, and he knew that all his knowledge and skills would be nullified if he refused Jonah's request. Without the least hesitation, he cut off his thumb and handed it to Jonah. Jonah took the thumb and thanked the prince. Raising his hand in blessing, he turned and walked away, followed by a relieved Arjuna. With his firm action, Jonah had clearly upheld religious principles.